Good morning. And as I noted in the email, recognizing that we have so much left to do still on the third topic, the topic of divorce, and I do not want to give short shrift to the fourth topic of same-gender attraction, I'm going to try to stay later in order to finish both. Of course, we'll have the audio recordings of both for anyone who is not able to stay later, but I would like us to be able to do something with each of them. So, Yom Yerushalayim Sameach, the Happy Jerusalem Day, year 50. Okay, I'm just working on it. That's all right. Good morning. Does everyone have sheets? Everyone has them? Okay. So, we're first taking care of the divorce topic. That we can finish that one. We established in part one that you have these two fundamental aspects of relationships. You have the Adam 1 relationship, which is procreation, to be able to fulfill pruer avot, to bear fruit and multiply. And then, in the second chapter of Bereishit, in Genesis 2, we have the idea of growth together as ethical spiritual beings following divine commands. And we established in our second segment on marriage that Jewish marriage introduces the idea of rituals and a durable commitment over what it perceives as the pre-Sinai form of marriage, trying to create an environment that is a sound environment for having children, and which also will encourage the partners to focus on each other to fulfill moral and spiritual growth. And that was what we had done in the marriage conversation. Then we started on divorce. And I pointed out the passage from the Family Law Act that we're going to have to come back to, which talks about what happens when one member of the couple refuses to offer a religious divorce. But then we went back to talk about what happens in the Torah when marriage breaks down. And we gave the example first of marriage breaking down in terms of frustration of ethical growth. The second model, we talked about the generation of the flood and how the Torah describes what's going on there of men of power taking women, whether they were single, whether they were married, taking them by force, and how that is described there as the grounds for flooding the world. And then we started talking about marriage as well as marriage breaking down in terms of frustration of procreation. The story of Ada and Sila, where this fellow Lemech, who is the seventh generation down from Cain, has two wives, one of whom is dedicated for procreation and the other of whom is dedicated for beauty. And how this is a polemic against that practice which separates effectively marriage from procreation. If you take a look on your sheet, it's source number one. I brought you just the opening verse from the passage that we read last time. And Lemech took two wives. One was named Ada meaning pregnant, and the other one was named Sila, indicating beauty. And that was the beginning of the passage. I didn't bring the entire passage again. But that splitting of the two, which separates marriage from procreation, is the problem, and it recurs in the Torah. If you're familiar with the story of Yehuda and Tamar, so this is a very difficult story. This is one of those stories that they skip when kids learn Genesis in day school, because you just don't want to go there. But Judah is one of the sons of Jacob right after the sale of Joseph. Joseph is sold down to Egypt. And after that, we're told that Judah descends from among his brethren. The Midrash comments there that stories actually don't follow in sequence chronologically in the Torah. It's actually moved to be juxtaposed with Joseph's behavior it's juxtaposed in two ways. Number one, because Judah does not speak up to keep Joseph from being sold, and therefore he is brought down by his brothers. He's no longer their leader. But then second, because if you remember what happens with Joseph in Egypt, where the woman of the house makes an attempt at Joseph, what today we would call sexual harassment, actually workplace harassment, in contrast to that, you have this story involving Yehuda, involving Judah, in which he gets married to a local woman, and he has sons, and then the first son gets married to a woman by the name of Tamar, and and the we're going to come back to what happens there, but his son dies, and then in the practice of the time, before the Torah has a mitzvah of Yibum, there's a tribal practice of marrying the widow, keeping her within the family, and the brother marries her as well, and then this brother dies, and then there's a third son, and Judah refrains from marrying off his son to Tamar. You're familiar with the story?
Yes.
Okay, so then I don't need to go further with it, because I've already hit the important part that's relevant for us, which is that the Torah describes the sons who died as being wicked. And it's not clear exactly what they did at first, but it says that Er, the first of the sons, was wicked in God's eyes. And then we're told about Onan as well. And then with Onan, we're actually told what it was that he did wrong. He did not want Tamar to become pregnant. And he acts in order to prevent himself from impregnating Tamar. So if you take a look at source number 2, you find out Rashi's explanation for why Er and Onan both do this. Why don't they want Tamar to become pregnant? And the explanation here is, lest she become pregnant such that her beauty would be diminished. And this actually goes back to their mother. Meaning that when Er, Onan, and the third brother, Shelah, are born, the Torah says, and he was in Kiziv when she birthed him. And either Kiziv is a place name, it's a location, or Kiziv can be taken to be a word in Hebrew which means something which is unappealing. Suggesting that maybe something was going on, her beauty was degraded, and that the kids picked up on this, and the kids said, you know what, we don't want to have children with Tamar, both Er first and then Onan, and they acted in order to prevent her from becoming pregnant, lest she lose her beauty, and the Torah condemns it, and Er and Onan lose their lives for this in the biblical account. So what you're getting here is a statement against the separation of marriage from procreation. As we said when we discussed marriage, not everyone is able to have children. That's the way it goes. For whatever reason, whether because of fertility issues, whether because of issues for the man or for the woman, or because it wouldn't be healthy for them to have children, and there are numerous reasons for that. But the message is that this is supposed to be a goal. And if they can't physically, then maybe there's an option for adoption for some people. But fundamentally, it's supposed to be create a home, create an environment in which children will be raised. And for someone to attempt to separate this out, to frustrate the procreative element, is so damaging to the marriage that it is indeed potentially grounds for divorce. So the Torah recognizes that marriage can break down, and it has a system of divorce. So here you have to ask a question, which is, that's what the Torah presents. And the Torah is going to give us a set of laws for how divorce is done, and we'll talk about it. But what does the Torah think came first? Just like with marriage, when we said, what does the Torah think marriage was prior to Sinai, and what is it afterwards? What does divorce look like as far as the Torah is concerned for non-Jews? So take a look at source number 3, where Maimonides, based on a passage in the Jerusalem Talmud, offers an explanation. This is referring to non-Jewish rules. From Maimonides, at what point is another man's wife like our divorcee? Meaning, another man's wife among non-Jews, when will she be like a divorcee would be within Judaism? And the answer is, when he removes her from his home and sends her off on her own, or when she leaves his domain and goes off. They don't have divorce by text. There's no written document. And it is not dependent on him, meaning to initiate it. Anytime he or she wishes to separate from each other, they separate. Mutual agreement. Well, not mutual necessarily, it's unilateral. But unilateral from either side. He can decide he wants out. She can decide she wants out. The assumption here is that the home is his home, which historically was you know, what happened, meaning when people got married, the wife would move into the husband's home, so she ends up being the one to leave the house. That your mileage may vary in our day, but what he's suggesting is they simply decide we're no longer married and that's it.
Is it like a common law marriage, or they actually are married?
So Maimonides, keep in mind, is not really going into any religious system outside of our own. He's describing the way that the Torah would look at their marriages. So what he's saying is the Torah does recognize marriage for non-Jews among themselves, and that may have ramifications within the Torah's laws. So for example, one of the seven mitzvot that are said to apply to everybody, right, is sexual morality. And so therefore adultery is a prohibition for them also. So they have a system of marriage which the Torah will recognize, and they have a system to end marriage, which is one of them says, I've had enough, and leaves. And that's that. Keep in mind, Maimonides lives within Muslim culture. Right?
Where they say, I divorce you.
Where, exactly, the triple statement is sufficient. So it's not so surprising. And so, you know, there's a consistency there. There's no need for a divorce decree. There's no need to go in front of a court. They opt out, and the marriage ends. In Judaism, though, it is more complex. And the reason for this, I think, goes back to what we talked about in terms of what changes with marriage for Jews once we arrive at Sinai, which is to say, the formalization of marriage. When we looked at marriage, we saw that Jewish law emphasizes financial security, and in particular, creates financial obligations upon the male, right? We went through all the 10 different obligations that exist, ranging from, you know, food and shelter to medical care, to ransoming her if she's taken captive, taking care of her daughters, taking care of her sons from the marriage, and the whole nine yards, all the different obligations, which came with certain trade-offs for him, in the sense that he accepts all these financial responsibilities for her. On the other hand, he receives her income. Right? We went through all of this. This shouldn't sound unfamiliar, but it comes with a trade-off, which is that since he initiates this marriage transaction, only he is able to initiate divorce, and that's the problem. You know, that's the problem. But that's the fundamental point. Once you structure this as a transaction in which he is the initiator and she is the one who agrees to it, and yes, she has to agree to it, but nonetheless, he is the initiator of the transaction, that also means that he's going to be the one to say, and now it ends. Diane.
But didn't we have a thing last week where she just goes and says, I can't live with this guy anymore?
Good. So Diane gave you the perfect segue. We talked about last week the fact that there are a number of circumstances in which we're told he is compelled to divorce her, even if he doesn't wish to. So, for example, in the event that she says, he is physically repulsive to me, I'm not interested, then we say to him, you're going to have to divorce her. Right? We talked about this. That's one example of a few. So why are we not worried about the possibility that she's going to be stuck in this marriage and he's going to simply decline to divorce? And the answer is that classically there were escape mechanisms built in. First of all, the escape mechanisms that lead to them being compelled, one of which is where she refuses sexual interaction. But more to the point is the ability of the courts to compel him to divorce. There's a principle which is brought in the Talmud, which is applied in a few different circumstances. The Hebrew is Kofin oto ad sheyomar rotze ani. Hebrew speakers, Kofin oto ad sheyomar rotze ani means? Kofin. What's kfiya? What's kfiya? Not a hair, not a headdress. To force, to coerce, correct. Kfiya datit is religious coercion. The Kofin oto ad sheyomar rotze ani means we coerce him until he says, I want. We convince him to volunteer is another way to look at that.
It doesn't always work
today, and this is something we have to discuss a little bit. But take a look at source number four, where Maimonides gives you the gives you the his explanation for why this works, because there is a principle in the Talmud which states that a get meuseh, a compelled bill of divorce, is invalid. So keep that in mind as you read this. If the law is that we compel this person to divorce his wife, you've reached whatever threshold it is where he's indeed supposed to divorce, and he does not wish to divorce, then a Jewish court of any place or time, meaning not limited to the times of the temple, not limited to a court of a certain caliber, strikes him until he says, I wish it, and he writes the get, and it is kosher. And then Maimonides asks the question, and why is this get not void? For he has been forced. To which he explains, the term forced only applies to one who has been pressured to do that which the Torah does not obligate him to do, such as one who is struck until he sells or gives away property. If you force someone to do something that's not a religious obligation, that's coercion, he says. So forcing someone to engage in a commercial transaction, that would be a problem. But no, the point isn't that. The point is financial transaction in the sense of something that's not required by law, but just something that you would enter into voluntarily. Forcing someone to eat food would be the same thing. But one whose evil nature forces him not to fulfill a mitzvah or to perform a transgression, and he is struck until he does that which he is obligated to do, or until he abandons that which he is prohibited from doing, he's not called forced. He has forced himself, meaning to refuse, through his wicked mind. Therefore, the man who does not wish to divorce, since he wishes to be a Jew, he truly wishes to perform all of the mitzvot and to distance himself from transgression, and it's just that his nature forces him to sin. Once he is struck to the point where his desire diminishes and he says, I wish it, he has divorced willingly. That's the idea. What you need to do is you know, ask yourself, is this really a level playing field before? Yeah, Annette.
I actually find that particular problem solving extremely optimistic, because it speaks to perhaps having a holy soul. I think if you add the idea that actually there is a wicked mind, but his, you know, the integrity, the neshama, is in fact holy. He is actually getting back, or she is getting back to their real self.
Yes.
So in fact, I think that I think that speaks to forgiveness. I think mm-hmm. I think it's actually a very optimistic and kind.
Right. Yeah. No. And I would tend to agree. This is a very positive view of the human soul. This is, we are all good on the inside. For some people, you have to look harder to find it, and sometimes people need a little bit of help. When I was a shul rabbi, I had certain cases in which there was a refusal to give a get. Not that many, thank God, but there were a couple. We did not, for the record, engage in anything that could involve criminal proceedings. In one case, the fellow had an 80-year-old mother living in Israel, and I called her up at 3 a.m. and told her what her son was doing. He called me back in 10 minutes, and he was willing to give the get. The reality is, by the way, that it's not only the husband who can refuse. Meaning, the way that divorce works within Judaism is that it has to be willing on both sides. There's a possibility that she refuses the bill of divorce, where she doesn't care about necessarily having a religious document, but she knows that the husband does. I had such a case in which the man told her straight out. He said, "I'm not going to refuse anything. I want to give you the get and everything else." And once she knew that he was going to go ahead with it, so she said, "Well, I'm not." And she was the one who held out. We took care of that one also. Yes.
I was just going to. I'm sorry for interrupting.
No.
The movie The Get. Did you see that?
I did not see it.
Oh, it went year after year on year.
Right.
I suffered with that.
Right.
And
without a doubt, meaning I want to get to the case of today, but let me just actually go step by step. the idea of compelling historically, you know, don't kid yourself, was physical. I mean, that's what it meant. It meant beat him up. That was what was done. Today in our society, that's against the law. If you take a look at source number 5, under the bullet point for coercion, you can have a link to this story where I knew the main player involved. The main player involved on the side of coercing the men is somebody who I had a bad run in previously when he was on the other side. When he was somebody who was hired for the man's side in a particular situation, and I don't want to go into details because it actually involved Toronto, so I'd rather just leave it be. But he was a hired gun, and whoever hired him, that's who he was going to help, and he got caught. But today the coercion that Maimonides is talking about is not an option. And even financial coercion can be problematic and can be an issue of coercion as well in a way that would disqualify the get. So the prenuptial agreements, and I gave you the link there where you could actually go to the website, theprenup.org, where you could see the prenup that I was describing last week. The way prenup agreements are generally designed and the way the Family Law Act clause is designed as well are designed to create a system in which he agrees to something himself. Well, separate it out. The way that the prenup that's used in the United States works is that he agrees from before the marriage that in the event that they are no longer living together, he is going to pursue a bill of divorce, and for each day that he refuses to do so, he will pay a certain sum, we'll call it support, and it's indexed to the consumer price index in case this is 30 years later or 40 years later and prices have changed for things and the value of what he's providing has changed. And as I said, those work very, very well. So that goes back to the question that was asked last week about the Lieberman Clause. In the conservative movement, there is something called the Lieberman Clause. Rabbi Shaul Lieberman effectively created this sort of agreement, but put it into the ketubah. Within Orthodox circles, there's a reluctance to mess with the ketubah text, particularly because, I think I mentioned it last week, we have this idea of not having a conditional marriage. And theoretically, if they were to reach this point where that clause were activated, you could end up backward disqualifying the ketubah because he didn't honor the agreement that was in it, and that I think is the objection to using it as a clause in the ketubah. However, as I noted then,
but not maybe part of the ketubah of an Orthodox ketubah, but just a procedure that is done at the same time.
Right. So that was what I mentioned last week. The Rabbinical Council of America says that rabbis who are members, I am a member, it's strongly recommended, should make sure that couples will have a prenup before you will officiate the marriage and not to officiate without it. The reason why it's only strongly recommended is because there are certain rabbis who reject the validity of the prenup, and not wanting to drum them out, it ends up being a very strong recommendation. It's usually not done the day of the wedding because there are too many other things going on the day of the wedding, but you take care of it in advance, that's all. There are even communities where they've done post-nups, and they tend to do it as a communal practice in which they'll agree to just such a document. They're already married, but they'll have all the couples in the community sign such an agreement, and by having everybody do it, it reduces the pressure on the individual. The wife who says, I would like to have this protection, but feels awkward about approaching her husband because he's wondering what she's contemplating. But if it's done communally, then there's no stigma attached with anybody doing it. I know it's been done in a community in White Plains, New York. It's been done on Long Island. And that's a way to take care of those who maybe got married before prenups came into vogue as a popular practice. The Canadian get law is different because, as we mentioned last week, Canadian law will not allow religious courts to handle family law situations. That goes back to a concern about Muslim practices, but it gets everybody in the same net. So instead, what you saw last week in the clause in the Family Law Act, I reproduced it in source number 6, is when a party fails to comply with subsection 5. We saw subsection 5 last week. But that's the one that says, I have removed all barriers, all religious barriers to remarriage. So if the party fails to comply, then if the party is an applicant, wants to apply for anything in terms of financial payments, custody, anything, their proceeding may be dismissed. The judge can simply say, I'm not hearing your filing until you take care of the religious barrier to remarriage. If the party is a respondent, meaning something has been filed against them, then the defense may be struck out. So they won't be able to defend against a claim for support. They won't be able to defend against a claim for custody and visitation and so on. You can't pretend that it's not a problem anymore, meaning this will not take care of 100% of all cases. So I'm familiar with a case in Montreal from a few years ago in which the man simply has no money and therefore can't have anything claimed against him for support. He's not involved in the Jewish community at all. He doesn't care about ostracism and people protesting or whatever. And he's made up his mind that he's simply never going to give a get for his wife. And it's a terrible situation. You know, if you had the option of the physical coercion, maybe that would be different. But this is a society in which that's not, that's not acceptable.
They had a Jewish marriage.
They had a Jewish marriage.
Did he argue that it wasn't a real Jewish marriage because he didn't really believe in Jewish marriage? He didn't believe in God because he doesn't believe in God to give a gift.
So I know of situations in which rabbinical courts have actually done all sorts of things to try to disqualify the original marriage. They'll look at the wedding video to identify who the witnesses were and try to figure out maybe they weren't really observant and therefore they weren't valid as witnesses. There are all sorts of suggestions that are actually used to try to disqualify it going back to the beginning. Marilyn.
Certainly in front of a Beth Din, that legal, outside legal help is allowed now, because I know someone who did represent the wife, and actually won. The husband refused to give her a get, and she hired, and it was, they got it.
Yeah.
And this was an Orthodox.
Mm-hmm.
It's a court order.
Right. I mean, this is a problem that Orthodoxy is still maturing in and figuring it out. This wasn't an issue 75 years ago. This is an issue which, once Jews are functioning as part of North American society, becomes a problem. And it took, call it 20 years or so, post-Holocaust, before the earliest prenups were in use. And as those percolate and become accepted within society, it reduces it. But we are living at a time when the problem hasn't been solved. And that's the fundamental problem that the community faces. And you have to be honest. This is still an issue. It's much better than it was 15, 20 years ago, but it's not as good as it's going to be 15, 20 years from now.
Is that the agunot
problem? Yeah, that's what it is. The word agun, you know, in Hebrew, an ogen is an anchor. The agunot is that they are anchored. They're anchored in the relationship. I think the more popular translation is chained. I think people use that image. Yeah.
I think today that when you want a divorce, it says in the divorce, you can't have a divorce until you give them the get.
So I don't believe that that's actually in the Family Law Act. I don't believe that's in the Family Law Act. No. If it were, you wouldn't need... You wouldn't need section 2. You know, what I brought in source number 6 here. I don't know. But I okay.
Many years ago, I have the article, I just go home to Google. They found in the Geniza in Cairo a bill of a ketubah, but in the ketubah it had to do with Joe Schmo traveled a lot. And in the ketubah it gave the wife some sort of prenup get, and I can't remember the exact. I will find it and I will email it.
Okay, I mean, it wouldn't.
I'm not mistaken. It was by Rambam who wrote the thing, but I can't remember.
Okay, it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, he found many documents in the Cairo Geniza in which you will find old ketubot, 1100, 1200, 1300 years old. I mean, the oldest ketubah we find is Second Temple period. you're talking a couple of thousand years old, but in the Cairo Geniza, you find ketubot, which, you know, will have the same system that we have today, but they were much freer in editing the ketubah. I think I mentioned last week, Sephardic communities are still much more comfortable than Ashkenazi communities are in terms of editing aspects of the ketubah. Where you get stuck is this issue of whether you could add in a conditional clause. But quite frankly, if you take care of it as a standalone document, then you don't have the ketubah problems. And you're better off than when you put it into a ketubah, because the ketubah is never going to be recognized in a secular court of law. Right? I think I mentioned that last week. Right? The ketubah is never going to be accepted in a secular court of law. It is in a language that people generally don't understand. It refers to currencies that nobody can match to the, you know, in any easy way to the Canadian dollar. You'd be laughed out of court in the U.S. or Canada if you tried to file a ketubah there. So putting this clause in the ketubah doesn't help you. You're better off as a standalone document. The last piece of this that I wanted to go through is a fascinating piece in source number 7. And that is the question of legitimate grounds for divorce. Understanding that divorce is valid when the parties are going to go through this bill of divorce, no matter the grounds. Nonetheless, it's instructive to see source number 7. Remember that divorce in Judaism is actually a mitzvah. Not a mitzvah in the sense that I have a checklist of 613 and I'm supposed to try to check off all of them. But in the sense that if one is going to divorce, this is a mitzvah to do it in this way. So here they're trying to frame for you what the mitzvah is. The school of Shammai says, one may not divorce his wife. The man is not allowed to initiate unless he finds a matter of erva. Erva means a forbidden relationship. Literally, it means that which is normally covered, ending up... literally, erva refers to a part of the body that's normally covered, but it's a code word here, because it's the term that the Torah uses when describing the forbidden relationships. They are called erva in the singular, arayot is the plural. So, according to the school of Shammai, the only acceptable grounds for divorce are infidelity. The school of Hillel says, even if she burns his food. Rabbi Akiva says, even if he finds another who is more attractive. Maximizing the freedom side of this. So what is this debate about? Well, the Talmud ties it to the verses in the Torah that actually describe divorce. So, for example, when it says the man wants to divorce his wife, ki matza ba ervat davar, because he found erva. So that's a fairly, you know, straightforward support for the school of Shammai. But on a philosophical level, this might be about the priorities we discussed for marriage in the first place. Beit Shammai's school, the school of Shammai says, stay together, you know, unless law forces you apart. Right? If there's been infidelity, if there's been this prohibited relationship, then the law is going to force you apart. And at that point, you have a mitzvah of divorcing. Sorry? Of the wife or of the...
Force, would a husband and wife be forced to divorce if the wife was raped?
By the husband or by somebody else?
By somebody else.
By somebody else? No. The Kohen is a unique situation, potentially, depending on the circumstances. But other than that, certainly not. If it was done by the husband, then he could be compelled to divorce her. The Beit Hillel says that that he wants them to stay together unless anger is separating them. In other words, he's getting angry. He says, you know, she burned my food, and he has an anger management issue where this is such a big deal to him. You know, and the answer isn't just, you know, make your own dinner. But he just can't get past this. It's keeping them from having the Genesis 2 type of relationship. And then Rabbi Akiva says, stay together unless, you know, he finds somebody who's more attractive. And I would connect this to the Genesis 1 model of procreation. This might be a stretch. I'm not sure whether you can really match this up to the Genesis 2 and Genesis 1 models. I might be stretching it with this. But I thought you had to actually bring the... You had to discuss the source. You can't not have it here. Sorry?
But Rabbi Akiva, this way you can have two wives, right?
Yes, all of them live when you can.
Right. I'm
Although
saying,
by their day, they're not really doing that.
But if you find one that's more attractive, you can keep the air and the spare. You can have two.
Only in the event that you can provide all of the different benefits for all of them, right? Then theoretically. But like I said, by his day, this isn't happening. Okay. So this has been a little bit of a run through some of the issues that are involved, at least to be familiar with them somewhat. The time we spent last week on it and this week. Yeah, Miriam.
Yeah. Can I ask something about the ketubah?
Yeah.
So, is it still written in Aramaic?
Yes.
Why?
Nobody
understands what's there.
No, I think tradition.
Because I don't know how many camels I'm going to get if I want to be born. So.
It doesn't mention any camels. There are no camels harmed in the making of the ketubah.
Goats.
You put it on, unless you put it on. Right. No, it mentions zuzim. It mentions coins. Right. Clearly. No, the ketubah mentions currencies. The problem is that our currencies aren't the same as theirs, but that's not an Aramaic problem. The word zuz is the word zuz in Hebrew and in Aramaic. It's not going to change anything. But if you want to, I'll tell you what. When I send out the follow-up link when I send up the follow-up email, I will send out a link for the English text of the ketubah, so that now you will know. Sorry. No, I'm going to send you the standard Ashkenazi version of it. That's the. But in answer to your question. In answer to your question, the officiant is supposed to explain it. The officiant is supposed to explain to the participants what is going on.
Doesn't know Aramaic either.
That's a separate problem. But in all seriousness, the officiant is supposed to explain it to the parties who are involved. I would say that if you're concerned about that, then you should skip Hebrew and go to English. Right? In other words, why put it in Hebrew as opposed to Aramaic? Unless you're going to say, well, I'm in Israel or with a community where people actually know the Hebrew, but aren't Aramaic proficient. Realistically, there's nothing to stop anyone from actually having an English version of it there as well. But from.
It would be fine, but not Aramaic.
What can I tell you?
We have 21st century. Maybe they can read it in
English. Right. But the challenge is always going to be the same, which is we have a tradition. We have a ketubah going back 2,000 years, at least, of people doing it in Aramaic, and therefore people don't like to mess with it. Their feeling is, if someone wants to know what it means, it's easy enough to find out what it means. Why not just leave the text the way it was and read a translation? I think that's the origin of it. Whether people want English or Hebrew or Italian. It's not as though it's unavailable.
If all the ketubot are the same, then what's the point?
What do you mean?
It doesn't refer to your own marriage. It refers to marriage.
No. All the names, their names change.
Yeah, you put the names, but you don't know how many goats you are going to get.
What's with the goats? There are no goats in your ketubah. It's money. If you want, we can continue the conversation. I see. Don't worry.
I have a small comment.
Yeah.
That when you go to apply for a ketubah, I'm sure many people here who have children who've done that, they're professional ketubah companies.
Yes.
And there are ketubahs that are geared to Orthodox,
yes.
Conservative, and Reform,
yeah.
Ceremonies. Yes. So they may be having a
man, yeah.
They may be a Hebrew, but they conform
Right, no, Miriam, I think, was asking me about Orthodoxy particularly. Yeah. But
even those
vary.
Yes.
Even those
vary. Yeah, they do. Because I remember when my kids got married, a couple of them that they brought to Rabbi Taub at that point were not acceptable and they had to.
Right, but that's not what she's saying. She's saying that there's variation in terms of acceptable ketubot. I go back to what I had said in the beginning. Among Ashkenazim, there's a great reluctance to modify the text of the ketubah. Among Sephardim, there's a lot more openness to changing amounts of money and things like that are recorded in the ketubah. There will be some variation. There will be an Israeli version versus a North American, even among Ashkenazim, but not of a substantive change. That you're just not going to see. And you can look around and you'll see. The translations are all available. I'll be glad to translate anything that you show me so I can see it and show it to you as well. But generally speaking, the ketubot are fairly consistent down the line. The basic elements of the ketubah remain so-and-so and so-and-so are getting married. The agreement is that he's going to pay such-and-such to her family. And here are the other obligations that he accepts upon himself. And the witnesses at the bottom sign their name. That's your basic structure of a classic ketubah. But I'll send out a link to the translation. It's worth seeing it. And you know, your mileage may vary in terms of what you find. But that's what I would say. All right.